From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the crisis in northern Iraq. Green light for use of experimental Ebola drugs. Ukraine says it will block unapproved Russian aid, plus the death of actor-comedian Robin Williams. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. An Iraqi helicopter carrying desperately needed aid to stranded Yazidi refugees fleeing Islamic extremists in northern Iraq has crashed, killing the pilot, injuring others on board. The chopper had just delivered emergency aid packages and picked up some refugees when it went down. International community is rushing to deliver aid to the thousands of ethnic minority Yazidis stranded without enough food or water on Mount Sinjar, which is in northwestern Iraq. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Tuesday spoke with reporters at the UN in New York about the situation in Iraq.
The people of Iraq and all of the Iraqi people need security, yet the poison of hatred and brutality is spreading. The so-called Islamic State, IS, is a threat to Iraq, Syria, and the region. I'm profoundly dismayed by its barbaric acts, including accounts of summary executions, boys forcibly taken from their homes to fight, girls abducted or trafficked as sex slaves. The plight of Yazidis and others on Mount Sinjar is especially harrowing. UN humanitarian personnel are in the area doing all what we can. Airdrops of food and water are reaching some of the trapped people. But the situation on the mountain is dire. And even when people manage to find a way out, they remain exposed to searing heat and perilous odyssey. I urge the international community to do even more to provide the protection they need. And I condemn in the strongest possible terms, the systemic persecution of individuals from minority population and those who refuse the extremist ideology of IS and associated armed groups.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking at the United Nations in New York on Tuesday. United States continuing to pound the Islamic State militants with bombs to keep them away from the refugees and to prevent them from advancing any farther across Iraq. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has ruled out sending combat troops to Iraq and has urged Iraqi Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi to quickly form an inclusive government. Mr. Kerry was in Sydney on Tuesday, along with U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, for their annual U.S.-Australian ministerial talks. We get more now from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
While the United States has conducted airstrikes against extremist Islamic State militants in northern Iraq, John Kerry said that American combat troops would not be sent to join the fight. Kerry said the solution to the crisis in Iraq was a unified and inclusive government in Baghdad that embraced all Iraqis. The Americans are supporting the nomination of Haider al-Abadi as Iraq's prime minister-designate in place of the incumbent Nouri Maliki. Kerry says Iraq's fate is in its own hands.
Well, let me tell you in the simplest terms where the discussion begins. There will be no reintroduction of American combat forces into Iraq. This is a fight that Iraqis need to join on behalf of Iraq. Because if you don't have a government that is inclusive and that works, nothing else will work, plain and simply.
Thousands of civilians in northern Iraq have fled the brutal advance of the Islamic State, formerly known as ISIL or ISIS. Many are stranded on a mountainside and have been without food and water for more than a week. Peter Jennings, director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, an independent think tank, believes that the United States will launch more airstrikes to help those fleeing the violence.
An air campaign alone won't be the complete solution, but it certainly will complicate the attempts of ISIS to consolidate the caliphate and also to present a threat to those minority groups that it is currently attacking in the north of the country.
Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
The skies over Gaza were quiet for a second day on Tuesday in the midst of a 72-hour ceasefire, but Israeli negotiators reported no progress in their talks with Palestinians on a permanent end of the fighting. Negotiators focused on Israel's blockade of Gaza, where Hamas militants running the area say they want a seaport open to promote economic development. Israel says it fears ending the blockade now would allow Hamas to restock weaponry from abroad and that could be used against Israel if fighting resumes. Israelis in the communities close to the boundary with Gaza are trying to recover from the month-long conflict in which more than 3,000 rockets were fired into Israel. Some have returned to their homes, but others say they still live in fear. VOA's Scott Bob reports from a kibbutz some 2 kilometers from the Gaza border.
Workers at Kfar Aza repair a roof damaged by a rocket from Gaza. No one was hurt. Most families evacuated when the conflict started, leaving only a few to care for the place. This community of 800 people was hit 15 times during the recent conflict. One man, the head of a local college, was wounded coming home from work. He heard the warning but did not have time to take cover. Teacher Orit Sadikovich says when the siren sounds, she has almost no time to get her 4 children into the safe room.
In the middle of the night, there is an alarm, and I have 15 seconds, to run to a shelter place, to the safety room, which is built out of concrete, and I have to choose what children I'm going to take first.
Nearby Sderot has been hard hit since Hamas seized power in Gaza, as can be seen by the rockets on display at the police station. Many residents are angry with the government, says former mayor Eli Moyal.
Because somehow, somewhere, people in this place believing that probably the Israeli government cannot provide the security needed in here.
Meanwhile, back at Kfar Aza, workers continue the cleanup, this one from a mortar shell. Sadikovich was born in this community, founded by her parents more than 50 years ago. She has lived here all her life.
Now it's the first time in my all 43 years that I live here in this kibbutz that I am thinking about leaving the place.
She says this is the third war in 6 years and that her children are showing the effects of the constant stress.
We don't know, and it's very sad to live life like that. So even if you see there nobody got killed, we get killed inside. Every time, every alarm, every day that is not quiet. It's killing us.
Community leaders also worry that the kibbutz production of farm and plastic goods could be affected if the cycle of violence continues. Scott Bob, VOA News, Kfar Aza, Southern Israel.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Ukrainian officials say they will not allow Russian trucks to cross the border after Moscow said it was sending a convoy to deliver aid to the besieged residents in eastern Ukraine. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports Ukraine and its international allies accuse Russia of trying to use humanitarian relief as a guise for a military incursion into Ukraine.
Russia said Tuesday it is sending 280 truckloads of relief supplies to residents of eastern Ukraine caught in the conflict between Ukrainian armed forces and pro-Russian separatists. However, Ukrainian officials say the Russian trucks are not part of an agreement with the International Committee of the Red Cross to deliver aid to the region. In Kiev, Ukrainian presidential adviser Valery Chali said the aid convoy has not been certified and that Ukraine will be forced to respond if Russia tries to include any military component in the aid mission.
If it will be convoy of military, some military operation, something else, it's definitely it would be considerate, and this will be named only an act of aggression, so we'll react in this manner.
He said the Ukrainian government has agreed that the Red Cross will be responsible for accepting and distributing Russian aid without military convoys. Russian news agency Itar TASS quotes a Russian Emergencies Ministry spokesman as saying 2,000 tons of supplies, including baby food, medicine, and drinking water, left Moscow early Tuesday for the Ukrainian border, and that the destination will be decided by Red Cross and Ukrainian officials. On an official Twitter feed, the Red Cross said it has been told by Russian authorities about the aid heading to the border and added, "We're not in charge of this convoy at the moment." The Red Cross says it needs to clarify details about the delivery, including the type and amount of aid, and said that it is working with Russian and Ukrainian authorities on this issue. Officials in Kiev say Russia continues to supply rebels in the east as the Ukrainian military says it is closing in on the remaining separatist strongholds. Ukrainian Deputy Foreign Minister Danilo Lukivsky told reporters that Russia can improve the situation in the east by stopping its support of rebel groups.
Stop the aggression. Stop the Russian terrorists. Stop the shelling. Stop your cynical propaganda. And there will be no need for any humanitarian aid.
In a phone call Monday, U.S. President Barack Obama and Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko agreed that any unapproved Russian intervention in Ukraine would be considered a violation of international law. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Kyiv.
World Health Organization has given a green light for the use of unproven drugs to fight the deadly Ebola outbreak in four West African countries. We get more now from Lisa Schlein at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
There have been a number of Ebola outbreaks in Eastern and Central Africa over the past 40 years. The World Health Organization was able to stop those outbreaks by identifying and isolating all cases of the disease, tracing those who have come in contact with infected individuals, and providing protective covering to healthcare workers. But officials from the UN Health Agency acknowledge what has worked in the past is not working now. They say the outbreak in four West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, continues to spread and appears to be unstoppable. Therefore, WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says the panel of experts who convened Monday unanimously agreed that it is ethical to offer unproven medicines as potential treatments.
The magnitude and the spread of the outbreak makes it that we don't have enough people to use and to rely only, if I may say, on what has traditionally worked if we want to stop the outbreak as quickly as possible. So this is why, in these particular circumstances, the ethicists have felt that it was ethical to propose these treatments and this vaccine, although they have not been registered yet.
West African health authorities report that more than 1,800 people have come down with Ebola and more than 1,000 have died. There is no cure for this disease, which can kill up to 90% of its victims and is spread through direct contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. Researchers have found some potential treatments and vaccines that could help bring Ebola under control. But while a handful of these drugs have shown positive results in monkeys, they have not been clinically tested in humans to see whether they are safe and effective. The health of two American aid workers who got infected with Ebola in Liberia has improved since they were treated with an experimental drug known as ZMapp. This has raised hopes of other successful treatments by using this and other unproven drugs. While the WHO has given the go-ahead for the use of untested treatments and vaccines, Dr. Kini says certain ethical criteria must guide their use. These include transparency of care, informed consent, freedom of choice, confidentiality, and community involvement.
The panel also emphasized that because we know so little about safety and efficacy in humans, whenever these treatments are provided for what we call compassionate use, which means as defined as access to an unapproved drug outside of a clinical trial, then there is a moral obligation to collect and share all data generated.
The World Health Organization says it will push for the speedy start of clinical trials for Ebola drugs that look promising. It notes that trials for two vaccine candidates might begin by the end of September. Were this to happen, it says information regarding their safety could be available by the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Law enforcement authorities are saying that American actor-comedian Robin Williams committed suicide by hanging himself at his California home on Monday. The local assistant deputy chief coroner, Lieutenant Keith Boyd, spoke with reporters Tuesday about 24 hours after Williams' body was discovered.
On August 11, 2014, at approximately 11:55 a.m., Marin County Communications received a 911 telephone call reporting that a male adult had been located unconscious and not breathing inside his residence located at 95 St. Thomas Way in unincorporated Tiburon, California. The caller was distraught and indicated at that time that was an apparent suicide due to a hanging had taken place and that rigor mortis had set in. The sheriff's office, as well as representatives of the Tiburon Fire Department and Southern Marin Fire Protection District, were dispatched to the incident with emergency personnel arriving on scene at 12 p.m. The male subject, who was pronounced deceased by firefighters from the Tiburon Fire Department at 12:02 p.m., has been identified as Robin McLaurin Williams.
63-year-old Williams was reportedly last seen alive at his home sometime late Sunday. A statement from his publicist said Williams had been battling depression. His longtime struggle with drugs and alcohol also was widely known. Dr. Jay Singh is a Washington, D.C.-based expert on suicide, mental illness research, and treatment. He is a clinical associate at Yale School of Medicine and specializes in the treatment of depression and bipolar disorder. VOA's David Byrd asked Dr. Singh what part depression plays in suicides.
Well, what we know from statistics at the moment, David, is that approximately 75% of individuals who do take their own lives have been diagnosed at some point in their lives with major depression. That said, when it comes to the case of Robin Williams, we do know that he suffered from a disorder known as bipolar disorder, which is characterized by having very high manic highs and very low depressive lows. And it's when one is coming out of one of these depressive low states, like it seems like Mr. Williams was in, that we see the likelihood of suicide increase.
How are people supposed to know the difference between someone who is thinking of or has decided to commit suicide and someone who's just sad because of the circumstances of life?
This is certainly a challenge that clinicians grapple with every day, David. The important thing to understand is that, like most mental illnesses, mental illness that takes the form of a mood disorder, such as depression or bipolar disorder, is really just an extreme form of a normal human response to life circumstances. And where we draw the line in the sand is when we take a look at whether or not these signs and symptoms, so feelings of sadness, losing interest in recreational activities or leisure activities that you used to enjoy, having difficulties eating or sleeping, that in these circumstances that you're unable to function socially, function educationally, so have difficulties learning, or functioning occupationally, meaning being able to do your work as you used to be able to. So that's the line in the sand that we draw to really differentiate between individuals who are just going through a rough patch in life, as we all do sometimes, and individuals who perhaps warrant a clinical diagnosis.
What role do you think that Robin's struggle with addiction played in his decision to commit suicide? Do you think that was a factor?
It certainly could be. I'm very interested to see today, David, what the results of the autopsy are in terms of whether or not it could be that alcohol or illicit drug use could have played a role here. The reason being that in cases such as Chris Farley, John Belushi, what we saw in terms of their deaths was what's called a synergistic effect. The idea here is that either taking multiple drugs or having a mental illness as well as a drug addiction or alcohol addiction, when you combine these things, it's almost as if they were more than the sum of their parts alone, such that they significantly increase the risk of violence, be it towards oneself, so self-harm or suicide, or towards others.
And what do you think this will do to not only to the comedic community, but also to other people who look at Robin Williams as someone who had success, who was outwardly happy, who seemed to have, quote-unquote, it made, and yet he ends up taking his own life, apparently?
I think it's very important, David, that we take something positive from this. And I think there's a few positive points here. I think that one thing that it really does for us is it really humanizes the struggle that so many Americans have when it comes to the issue of depression or bipolar disorder. Approximately one in every 10 Americans at some point in their life will be diagnosed with this illness, and approximately 3 in 100 will be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So this is something where so many people these days have been either personally affected by one of these mental illnesses, or they have a friend or a loved one who has. It's also important, I think, as a takeaway message, to know at the end of the day what we're dealing with here is really biological illnesses. And just as we wouldn't blame someone who's diagnosed with cancer or with heart problems, we wouldn't place blame on them and say that they're weak per se by any means, it should be the same thing when it comes to something like depression or bipolar disorder. There's certainly a great deal of stigma there. And seeing that one of our heroes, one of our icons here in the States, like Robin Williams, can be suffering from such an illness, I think it's something where it really puts a loving, friendly, and kind face on an illness that impacts so many of us.
Dr. Jay Singh is a Washington, D.C.-based expert on suicide and a clinical associate at Yale School of Medicine. He specializes in the treatment of depression and bipolar disorder. Dr. Singh was speaking with my colleague, David Byrd. During his decades-long career in television and movies, Robin Williams entertained fans of all ages. He won acclaim for numerous films, including Mrs. Doubtfire, Good Morning Vietnam, and Good Will Hunting, which earned him the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in 1998. Reporters asked him if Good Will Hunting was the movie of all of his work for which he would have preferred to win the Oscar.
Oh, yes, this one, yes. The other ones were just foreplay. This is wild night. It's insane. I'm still like this. I was in there taking photos. I was like, hi, nice to be here. I have to change pants, but you'll understand that later. No, it is. It's extraordinary. I'm very proud.
Always funny, wasn't he? Born in Chicago in 1951, Williams was a stand-up comedian when he made his television debut in the late 1970s. Playing an alien in the situation comedy Mork and Mindy. He also acted on Broadway and continued performing stand-up comedy even after becoming a movie star, delighting audiences with his rapid-fire improvisational routines. Academy Award-winning director Steven Spielberg, who directed Williams in the 1991 film Hook, described the comedian as a lightning storm of comic genius. Outside of Williams' home in the town of Tiburon, California, north of San Francisco, people left flowers, with the entertainer's neighbors praising him for his kindness and that he was very nice. Late actor's wife, Susan Schneider, released a statement saying, and I quote, "As he is remembered, it is our hope the focus will not be on Robin's death, but on the countless moments of joy and laughter he gave to millions." In addition to his wife, Williams is survived by 3 adult children. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. If you find yourself on Twitter anytime soon and joining the conversation about what's happening around the world, I hope you'll look me up. I'm at VOA Norman. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Marty Curcius, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1521, the remnants of the Aztec army, weakened by European diseases and a lack of supplies, surrendered to Japanese conquistador Hernando Cortes. The capitulation brought the Aztec Empire, located in present-day Mexico, to an end and gave Cortes control over a vast territory that became known as New Spain. On this day in 1792, King Louis XVI of France, already in custody, was formally arrested by the rebel National Tribunal and declared an enemy of the people. On this date in 1899, movie maker Alfred Hitchcock was born in London. Hitchcock's innovative directing techniques and mastery of suspense made him one of the most popular filmmakers of the 20th century. He began his film directing career in Britain, but received international acclaim for his Hollywood productions with such titles as Suspicion, Dial M for Murder, North by Northwest, and The Birds. Hitchcock died in 1980. In 1954, on this date, Radio Pakistan broadcast the national anthem of Pakistan for the very first time. In 1961, communist-ruled East Germany closed the border and built a wall between East and West Berlin to halt the exodus of its people to the West. The Berlin Wall became a symbol of repression by communist regimes during the Cold War. In 1964, murderers Peter Allen and Gwen Evans were hanged, becoming the last people executed in the United Kingdom. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
40 years ago, the Communist Party of Cambodia, known as the Khmer Rouge, seized power and began a horrific social engineering experiment that resulted in the deaths of an estimated 1.7 million people. Under the leadership of Pol Pot, Nguyen Chia, Yeung Sari, Yeung Tirit, Son Sein, and Kyo Sampan, the Khmer Rouge attempted to create a purely agrarian-based society by systematically slaughtering the intelligentsia and forcing much of the population into agricultural labor. The Khmer Rouge ruled Cambodia from 1975 to 1979, but it took more than three decades and the determined effort of Cambodians and of the international community to see justice done on behalf of the victims of the Khmer Rouge before those responsible for one of the 20th century's worst atrocities were called to account for their crimes. In 2006, a special United Nations-backed tribunal, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, or ECCC, was convened to prosecute the leadership of the Khmer Rouge. By that time, Pol Pot and Son Sen were dead. Yeung Sari died before judgment could be reached at trial, and Yeung Tirit, who suffers from advanced Alzheimer's disease, was found incompetent to stand trial. Thus it was that Nguyen Chia, the former deputy secretary of the Communist Party of Cambodia, and Kyaw Sampan, the one-time president of the state that was then called Democratic Cambodia, that stood before the court when judgment was reached. On August 6th, both were sentenced to life in prison for crimes against humanity, murder, political persecution, and other inhumane acts during the movement of the population out of urban centers, and murder and extermination through the execution of Khmer Republic officials at Duol Po Tre. They were also found guilty of planning, instigating, aiding, and abetting the crimes of extermination, other inhumane acts in connection with the forced transfers, and political persecution. Additionally, Nguyen Chia was found to have ordered these crimes. The United States has long supported the goal of prosecuting those most responsible for the atrocities perpetrated by the Khmer Rouge regime. We must now help Cambodia's people see the job through as they usher in a new era of justice, accountability, and reconciliation. We welcome this historic verdict by the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia and continue to support the efforts of this court to secure justice and to shed light on the darkest chapter of Cambodian history.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.